auto-destruct sequence arm.
It's Friday, September 1st, 2017. It's September, folks. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast, and we are back on Fridays, and I'm feeling good about it. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our capital muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. On today's program, Hurricane Harvey wreaks havoc in Houston and Texas. It's a devastating window into our climate future. Violent clashes between right-wing and anti-fascist protesters in Berkeley raises many questions about political strategy, media failures, and militarization of the police. Trump removes ban on supplying police departments with military hardware. Any connection there, you think? Harriet Tubman is officially off the $20 bill. Oh, and Joe freaking Arpaio. Really? No connection there.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
At least 100 faith leaders, activists, and students are walking from Charlottesville to D.C. for a march to confront white supremacy. They left on Monday and will arrive in D.C. on September 6th. Gorka kicked out of the big house. More staff drama. And Kamala Harris signs on to Sanders' universal health care bill. Harrisburg City Council voted to approve Harrisburg Police Department's request to purchase military-grade riot gear because Charlottesville? Senator Soprano, Scott Wagner, plays his anti-Semitic comedy routine this week in Pittston. Crickets. Alt-right advocate takes to the pages of Penn Live to cry, "We're not Nazis, we're just trying to preserve white heritage and identity." Dog whistle, dog whistle, dog whistle. And more on the We're Not Racist front. John McNesby, president of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 5, calls a group of Black Lives Matter activists rabid animals following a protest in front of a police officer's house. And today is Force Friday! That's right, get all your new Star Wars gear! Come on, man! Buy, buy, buy! Starting today at stores everywhere ahead of the Star Wars launch in December. Modern Times Coffee is awesome, and so is their new ownership model. Kevin gets a real grinder. but he misses Sour Sunday in favor of back to school. All right, as a reminder, folks, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'll be there giving the weekly resistance report once again. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on Dish Network, DirecTV, or use the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you miss the show, no problem. Just go to the ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar. As a reminder, we need you to help pull no punches, progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to the ragingchickenpress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click Become a Member, and you're on your way. Not ready to become a member? Hey, no problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking Donate. We need you, the progressive community, to help pull no punches progressive media. You know, the kind that holds power accountable. And I want to give a shout-out this week to our newest member, Chris W., coming in at the $10 a month level. He kind of joined in part because, we've got a special running right now. If you join as a member at the $10 a month level at RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab and become a member, if you become a member at the $10 a month level now, we will send you Mark Bray's new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Or, if you don't want that, for whatever reason, you can get the original Stay Woke Raging Chicken Press coffee mug. Coming at the $20 a month level, hey, we'll send you both. How's that? Right? So it's really, really simple. We're kind of building up for the fights ahead. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org, look for the support and membership tab, click become a member, and you're on your way. You can join in through Patreon. Sean and I have been also cooking up a whole bunch of cool stuff that we'll probably be launching late September and October, which is going to be some member-only content that you can only access if you become a member through Patreon. And it should be pretty cool. We're looking for doing some roundtables and a more informal kind of discussion. Who knows? Maybe we'll even do it with beer. We'll see, right? So here we go, Sean. Man, another week, man.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I got this week, I don't know about the Star Wars gear. I didn't hear about that. But I bought that MAGA hat that Trump was wearing all over Texas.
Dude, man, I bought four of them.
Oh, man, you outdid me there.
It was,
you know,
so
like,
cool.
Fuck, fuck disaster capitalism. We're going to start before the disaster is even done.
MAGA, 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 man. Make America great again. MAGA, MAGA, USA. Well, you know what? I'm waiting.
It's amazing. Like, it's amazing, but it's like not like totally unpredictable that Trump has found a way to market a like once in a thousand year storm.
Yeah.
To sell political campaign hats. I mean, Jesus. And people are like appalled by this.
Well, I heard that Melania has got her own kind of like economic development campaign getting ready to go for Houston.
Stilettos?
Yeah, she's actually opened a stiletto factory down in Houston. Not. Just wanted to know if those
were
made in the USA.
Like, all the public schools, you're going to need to put those kids to work somewhere. So
that's right. And you know, I hear those tiny hands are really good for assembling stiletto heels. So.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like the rolling back of the child labor laws at, you know, the 1920s and 1930s. You just go back, get rid of anything Mother Jones fought for, and just put these kids to work, because obviously we're going to do something after this, you know, catastrophic, apocalyptic climate disaster.
Oh, my God. I mean, and it really has been exactly that, too, as well. I mean, those kids are definitely going to need something to do. And what better to do than, you know, go back to the, you know,
stitching MAGA hats.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Stitching MAGA hats. So, but seriously, though, on the serious side of that, the Hurricane Harvey, man, holy crap. I mean, the amount of water that has come down there, I mean, you know, historic and by any measure. I mean, there's no way around it.
Yeah, I mean, like, this has you believing that the flood did happen, you know, with Jonah and
right.
Moses and all that. Like, but, like, seriousness aside, but, like, this... the spotlight of where this hit, I mean, like with climate change and Houston's role in being the energy exporter of
yep.
this country, of pretty much like this hemisphere, pretty much, you know, and Houston's role in like the petrochemicals and all the refineries down there. It's sort of like it's some sort of like irony that this happened there. I mean, it's horrible that it happened, but it's sort of ironic that it hits the heart of this country's oil producing area.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was wondering, you know, you always hear the kind of, you know, the right wing go crazy about, you know, this is God's way of punishing in a particular area, whatever. And you had Laura Ingraham that was out there this week basically saying that, you know, I'm not going to say this is God's punishment for electing a gay mayor or something like this, I think she said. I'm like, really? But I was curious about how they were going to spin that to get away from exactly this narrative that you just put on the table. I mean, you know, again, if you want to kind of like believe that there's a God up there sending messages down to us, I mean, you know, wouldn't the message come out of here like, hey, the people who are making, you know, this is where all the oil refinery is. This is what's going to happen. This is the look into your future. And instead they want to talk about some, you know, gay mayor or something.
Well, you did know that the preacher who says that God sends natural disasters to punish gay people and destroy their homes had his house destroyed this week. So,
so I'm not saying anything, but
leaves that question up in the air. You know, he might have some explaining to do to his congregation.
Well, maybe this was his way of coming out of the closet. It's crazy. But no, I mean, you know, we look at this, you look at what this has meant. You know, we're talking in Houston alone, we're talking 9 trillion gallons of water in Houston.
Well, this was actually like during the week. This is before the storm even stopped. This was during the middle of the storm. This Washington Post article. I think this is like the first time in history anyone could have seen like 50 plus inches of rain happening.
Hey, it's unbelievable.
In a storm. Think about that. Like 50 inches of rain. That's almost 5 feet of water.
Yep.
That's 4.5 feet of water right there, at least. My mouth's not cooking this morning, you know, but that's a shit ton of water. And the volume of that was, if you were to put that like as of Monday at noon or mm-hmm. as of Tuesday at noon, when they took this like measurement, like 9 trillion gallons of water, That's like a two cubic miles of water dumped in the Houston area.
It's unbelievable. And in that, you know, and that, I mean, we need these kind of visuals right now. I mean, in that same article, they're pointing to that. If you look at Texas, right, Texas is the amount of rain that was falling in Texas that as a whole, right, that has topped the 21 trillion gallons now. And that is basically enough to fill Utah's Great Salt Lake four times. And I was looking for some other measures. I mean, just trying to get my own head around how much water we're talking about. And they basically said if you took all the water, this came out of from Michigan Live, they did some calculations. If you took all the water that fell on Texas and you dumped that into the Great Lakes, it would raise all of the Great Lakes by nearly a foot. It's like 11.6 inches. I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. And also, like, the way the geography is, the geography of that area, Houston, it's sloped, like the mm-hmm. slope of that area is 1 foot a mile. So yeah. it's pretty like flat. It's a very flat terrain. And you think about that. I mean, we talk about sea level rise, you know, you talk about the oceans rising. This is that right there, right? This is that water is going to stay there for quite some time.
Yep.
I mean, that water is not going anywhere over the next month unless it evaporates because how close they are to the ocean, the Gulf. But I mean that's a foot a mile is slope, and it's either going to, you know, when we talk about sea level rise with hurricanes and storms, this is that right there.
No, that's absolutely right. And you know again, let's say it is going to take a while to drain. And you know, look, Houston has been notorious for flooding before because of exactly the reasons that you just laid out, right? And especially anytime you get any storm that's coming in from the Gulf, it's kind of pushing some water up there. But even heavy rains have flooded Houston before. But this, and we've got to say this, like, yes, Houston has flooded before when past storms. This is beyond anything. Rachel Maddow show earlier this week, they had some footage from, I think it was like the 1930s maybe or something like this, where they had other major floods in Houston, where the streets were filled with water and things like this. And again, it was not nearly the kind of development that Houston has undergone now, but it was they were showing that at 15 inches of water had flooded the streets. And you saw the video footage on that, and then to see this to 50 inches of water, right, plus all the development, right? So in other words, all the other blacktop, right, that does not allow the rain to go into the ground, for example, all that stuff is just decimating the city.
Oh, no, and this is a man-made disaster through climate change and through a boomtown-type development where we're just going to pave everything over, we're going to think about the consequences of not even planning anything out. Like this is a man-made disaster through the lack of planning, through the lack of just covering up any porous surface as possible, any and all surfaces. And also, you know, we're talking about 50 inches of rain here. Mm-hmm. This is a climate disaster.
Yes.
This is something that's going to happen. You know, that's going to happen more frequently. I was watching a video with Vox, right? And Vox had things like the amount of hurricanes is decreasing, right, you know, over the past few years, but the amount of storms, category 3 or 4 or 5 storms, bringing the intensity of rain level are increasing,
right?
So you might see like a decrease in like hurricanes, but you're seeing an increase in storms just dumping a huge amount of moisture. I mean, even in the wintertime, we're seeing it up here, you know, we're like, you know, you get a snowstorm dumping 20 or 30 inches. That might happen every couple of years, every like, you know, 10 or 15 years or whatever. We've gotten two of those storms within the past 2 years now.
No, that's right.
You know, I remember 1 year at Kutztown, we got like 3 blizzards back in like 2008 or 9, like 2 or 3 20-inch snowstorms within the span of like a couple of weeks.
Right.
That one winter. And it's like, it's because of the warmer water, the warmer oceans in the wintertime bringing in more moisture, more energy.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know... One of the things that you know, some of the models, remember we got all these deluges. It was like, I think 2 years ago, where you had these storms that were kind of tracking from kind of west to east, and then they were just sitting over the East Coast, right? And they were basically creating, you know, for all practical purposes, kind of stagnant nor'easters. And this is, you know, kind of what you're referring to. Kind of, we had this constant spinning, and that was just dumping like tons and tons of water on the East Coast. And at that time, climate scientists were talking about how this is one of the things that we can expect as part of climate change, is that, you know, part of what keeps the jet stream going fast, right, and kind of moving things from west to east across the U.S. at least, is that, you know, the temperature variant, the gradient, right? Basically, the differences in temperature and things like this, and how it's kind of moving the cold air down that keeps the jet stream going. But when we're warming the atmosphere and we're putting more moisture in the atmosphere, it actually slows the jet stream down. And one of the things that was interesting watching this, thinking about that and looking at what was happening with Harvey, because, I mean, Harvey came on coast and then just sat there, then went back out into the Gulf. I mean, it was this high-pressure system and a jet stream that wasn't moving. And then it kind of makes landfall again as a tropical storm. You know, this is the kind of stuff that we can expect. You know, nobody gets used to hurricanes, right? I mean, let's say that. But there was a certain pattern that you would see when they would come on shore and some would move slow, but they would eventually kind of track off. This is the kind of stuff that they're saying that we can expect more of. And right now they're tracking Hurricane Irma out in the Atlantic, and it's just formed recently off the coast of Africa. And, you know, they're saying, look, it's way too early to say where this is potentially going to track, but they are saying that, look, we've learned from past experience now that when we see these strong, powerful hurricanes forming off the coast of Africa and heading our way, we got to keep a very close eye on them, because some of them have turned into the worst storms that the U.S. has seen in the last decade.
Yeah, and, you know, some people are even saying that this might go up the coast. And, you know, another city that is completely not equipped for a hurricane is New York City, and we witnessed that back in Sandy. You know, one of the things that this hurricane's made me do is watch some of the stuff that happened with Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. And, you know, like, yes, we were pretty far inland, but even in the suburbs of Philadelphia, the devastation, was devastation of the infrastructure was felt out here.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, where we had, like, we were out without power for almost a week without power, and being in November. So not only it's like, you don't think a hurricane's going to hit November, but yes, a hurricane hit November. And what happened right afterwards, it brought in the cold weather, and we were without power, without heat in the house for like 4 or 5 days. And then the temperatures outside are already in the low 50s, upper 40s.
Right.
You know, it's,
well, I just remember the road. I mean, even just like the infrastructure after that, as you pointed to that. And, you know, again, as you said, I mean, we're not, Bucks County, we're not kind of right on the right where the hurricane majorly hit. But like, I remember County Line Road, for example, as one of the roads that sticks out to me and kind of that runs through Bucks County. It was like a war zone. Right. There were potholes in there that were, I mean, literally some of them were 8 to 12 inches deep. Right. And about like 2 feet wide in places.
And this is before we had this was before we had the infrastructure funding bill. I mean, the roads were bad enough.
Right.
At this
exactly.
Point.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we can see. And one of the articles I was reading about kind of Irma and what they're really watching is the two major cities that they're really most concerned about are New York and Miami. Because Miami hasn't been hit by a major hurricane, kind of like what we saw with Harvey, in a long time. But last time it was devastating. And for the same reason, New York and Miami, while they're looking at these two cities and being concerned about Irma coming in or additional hurricanes after seeing what had just happened with Harvey, is because of what you were pointing to with Houston right at the get-go, is both of these cities are, you know, not very, you know, much above, above sea level. And the water can just kind of push right up. Any kind of significant storm surge is just going to kind of completely flood the city. So,
and it's going to be interesting to see, like, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now, what happens to these cities. You know, Miami is starting to sink into the sea, literally starting to get swallowed by the ocean through the tide process, you know, high tide through high tides. So, like, something like a hurricane comes through, like, what's going to happen to the city? You know, this isn't going to be like, boom, it just happens and your city is underwater and you can't live there anymore. We're going to go through a 30, 40, 50 year process of mass migrations. You know, we're going to, like, this is the thing that, like, we're going to have to be preparing for in the future. And this is like the apocalyptic books that people read. I don't read science fiction and apocalyptic books, but, like, this is like this happening in real life.
No, it's funny you just said that, because I just pulled up on the screen. I said, I want to say, look, Kim Stanley Robinson's book, right? Kim Stanley Robinson's book, 2140. You know, I've mentioned this book before on this podcast. I read this earlier this year. It literally is. I mean, New York 2140, that's the year that this has kind of taken place. And it's basically after, takes place after there's been two kind of catastrophic events, climate-like events, and a good portion of New York City is permanently underwater. Right. And it's not just New York City. It's cities across the world. But, you know, it's really focused. The whole thing takes place in New York City. And I encourage people to go out and read this book. Right. 2140, because I think we need narratives. Right. That get us our heads around what this actually is going to look like on the long end. And the thing is about what I think Kim Stanley Robinson is so good about. Right. Because he's got this real kind of materialist bent in his fiction. Is that it's not like this all or nothing thing, right? Which is something, again, we've been talking about for a while now. It's not as if there's going to be catastrophic climate change and humans are going to be gone. It's like, no, what it's going to do, it's basically going to kind of like bring in a kind of hyper-capitalism and neo-feudalism, right? Because there are going to be people that are going to be more okay than others. And those are going to be the people that are consolidating all of their resources right now. Right. I mean, we talk about consolidation of wealth and inequality, right? Consolidation of wealth in the 1/10, the 1%, or the top 1%. Like, those people know this is coming and they are going to be fine. Right. What New York 2140 does, it also gets a window like, well, what's everyone else's life going to look like? Right.
And you know what the funny thing is, you know, maybe they'll like transition onto the next subject, but this is like the fights we're fighting right now, as we're seeing with the anti-fascist movements, the white supremacist stuff. You know, a lot of this, like a lot of the stuff in the future that we're going to be seeing with climate change is going to fuel what's happening today, especially with mass migrations of people, the resistance of people. You have militia groups out there. I mean, what's going to happen once our resources are gone? You know, you're going to have these people, well-armed militias, you know, pretty much like roaming the streets.
No, that's a great point. We're going to see. Great point.
I mean, like what we're seeing here with Charlottesville, with, you know, happened in Berkeley, what happened in Boston. Like, you know, this is the type of stuff, like these fights we're seeing now is only the beginning. And it's being driven by this capitalist society we're living in. But it's also it's being driven by this nativist society that we're forming at the very moment. You know, like it's not just because of white people are going to be a plurality by 2040. No, this is the type of stuff that, you know, like hate to sound like alarmist or conspiracy theorist or but if you like just read some of these fiction books, how's everything playing out and how people I mean, climate change is the single biggest factor in the destruction of our society. You know, Pentagon, it's the single biggest issue we have to pay attention to, but we're not. And, you know, you have mass migrations of people moving across borders or moving within borders. Just imagine the anti-refugee movements that are happening right now with the 3%ers, you know, how dead set against refugees they are. What's going to happen once people from these cities start moving into those that area or start moving inland more? No, they're going to start have to doing that.
No, that's right.
You're not going to be able to build a seawall to stop the flooding of Miami or Boston or Baltimore or New York City and stuff like that.
No, that's right. I mean, like, what do you think is going to happen to Houston, right? After these people have extracted as much as they possibly can and still occupy that stuff, you think they're going to clean up all the chemical plants and clean up all the refineries that are down there before they move away? No, it's just going to sit there. That stuff is going to sit and rot, right, and pollute the world. And these people, right, what we see the rise of the alt-right right now, and again, I can go to my dystopian space pretty easily right now and kind of follow the logic of where things are going. These are the people, this alt-right group, right? These alt-right groups that are emerging now, these are the people that are lining up, right?
They're preparing for the dystopian destruction of our society.
They are. If you read their language, I told you, we talked about this last week a little bit, right? When I went deep into alt-right YouTube, for a while there until I had to pull myself back, right? So I didn't fall into the abyss, right? That basically these people are already talking in apocalyptic terms, right? But they're doing it on race terms. So right now, these are the people that are already ready made to be the kind of the militias, like to back these kind of the top 1% in our climate disaster future, right? These are the people that will be on the front lines, right? killing people, killing those refugees, keeping those refugees out in order to secure the property rights of the people at the top. I mean, that's the way this stuff plays out. And if you follow any history of kind of like how the brown shirts came to power, then what they did, first they were extreme, then they were kind of brought in, and then they became authorized by the state, right? This is the same kind of dimension, although it's not going to look exactly like that. That's a thing that people always have to understand. It's not like history repeating itself word for word, right? It's just another different kind of scenario and social organization to support like a really, really bad situation, right? And climate disaster throws that stuff like through the roof. And what we're seeing right now, the way that the media is covering like this alt-right, the way that, you know, frankly,
Fox News hires Tomi Lahren.
Exactly. Exactly.
Legitimizing white supremacy, what neo-fascist, neo-Nazism. I mean, like, this isn't like some like good looking 20-some-year-old ditzy blonde that they're hiring, which is like their normal business model. Let's be real here. Their business model is based on sexism, you know, and having the good looking blonde on TV. No, they're hiring someone who is legitimizing the alt-right, who built her, grinded her teeth, legitimizing the alt-right, white nationalist, neo-Nazi movements. I mean, it's like basically taking one of these YouTube stars off of YouTube and putting them into a major media organization.
Yep. So let's follow this through as a string of logic, shall we? So one, we have the rise of the alt-right. Right. We've got Fox News, the most watched news show in the country. Right. Hiring the alt-right to bring it in and kind of legitimize it. Right. You have the media completely incapable of like covering a situation like what happened up in Berkeley in terms of the violent clashes up in Berkeley. Then what happens? Trump removes all a ban on supplying police departments with military hardware. Then Harriet Tubman is taken off the $20 bill. Oh, and then we're going to pardon Joe freaking Arpaio. Right. No connection here.
And then we're going to take away DACA.
And they're going to take away DACA, right? And so, I mean, what we have a media that is incapable of connecting the dots here.
Yeah, but you know, some you know, Antifa people beat up a bunch of alt-righters, and we got to talk about like this. I mean, like, yes, that did happen, and one of the things that I'm not going to deny that it happened, but that was only a small part of the story. And I definitely recommend you going over to Shane Bauer's piece in Mother Jones. It's in the show notes.
Yeah.
Shane Bauer is an investigative reporter who immersed himself in the CCA. You know, this was the journalist who was arrested in Iran for hiking near the border back in 2009. And this is why we had the Iranian nuclear deal to release these hostages. He was part of those hostages that were released. And he immersed himself in the Correctional Corporation of America for 4 months, working at a prison for like $10 an hour in Louisiana. He also immersed himself with a 3-percenter unit working on the working along the Arizona-Mexico border as a militia member.
Right.
You know, like this person put himself in the harm in like the teeth of danger more than a few times to do like this great reporting. Read up what he has to do. But he was basically like, the media is not getting the picture here. Yes, this violence happened, but it's only part of the story. They don't know how to cover this Antifa movement. They don't know the ways of doing it. Like, you know, a reporter got punched in the face because he was taking pictures of the anti-fascists. Well, yes, that's obviously wrong. You shouldn't be punching a reporter. But if that reporter did their due diligence, did the research, and know how they operate, they don't want their pictures taken for reprisals from either the state or reprisals from the fascists, the neo-fascists that they're protesting against.
No,
like, you know,
right.
When I was at a couple of these rallies, you know, I had a couple of people like, hey, don't take pictures of us. I'm like, okay. I was like, if something happens, I'm taking pictures and I'm documenting what's going to happen.
Right.
Like, I was taking a video of a confrontation to happen and someone was putting their hand in front of my lens. Like, listen, I'm not capturing your faces. I want to capture what's happening here in case something does go down.
No, exactly. But I think, you know, again, there's these are tricky arguments, right? I totally get just what you said. Totally understand that. And then, it's, you know, the thing is, right? And so then, but then I just worry about that stuff. But my thoughts aren't kind of all out on that. The thing is that once we start having everybody is masked, right? Then we're in trouble. The problem is that I think that there's no alternative really, because we've seen almost all of police violence at these things is directed at the left. right? And that's where, I mean, again, this is really
cool. I was watching, so a tweet went viral over the weekend. 1939, Washington, or 1938, 22,000 Nazis gather in the garden. Mm-hmm. Police focus on demonstrators.
The Earth moves closer to the sun every year. We have more people. You know, humans have warm bodies. So is heat.
Sorry about that.
Getting a little excited over there.
I accidentally hit the soundboard, folks.
Well, Hurricane Harvey did happen because we weren't moving closer to the sun.
Senator Wagner? I think it was like the accident that we're talking about this right now, and I hit the button of Wagner talking about the Earth moving closer to the sun and people being warm is why we're having climate change. It's interesting. But anyways, you were saying 1939.
No, 1939. Washington Post or New York Times had an article up. Basically, like the headline read, 22,000 Nazis gather in the garden. Madison Square Garden's big rally that happened. Matt was talking about, others were talking about over the past few weeks. And the focus of the story focused on the protesters outside getting in clashes. Like, you know, you also look at the history of the Cable Street in England, and right?
Yep.
You know, the Battle of Cable Street. One of the things that was focused was the left, the state, the police, beating up the protesters, the counter protesters, in order for these people to have their march.
Yep.
Like, this type of stuff has been happening for decades now.
No, and if people have been following what's been happening in terms of policing, right? I mean, you're seeing the pattern move forward in the same direction, right? You've seen the militarization of the police. You've seen the decline of community-based policing. You've seen the further training of police departments in kind of thinking
the militarization.
About what's that?
The militarization of the these
militarization
police departments.
And looking at community and community groups, especially poor Black and Latino community groups, as the enemy, right? That you are potentially going to be attacked.
A bunch of rabid animals, as we'll talk about in the next section.
Oh my God, that threw me for a loop, man. I'll tell you.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
It was that was so over the top. I just can't believe it. I mean, that it was an actual quote in the paper that he gave to a reporter. That's what blew my mind. But we'll talk more about that in the next segment. But here, one of the things I wanted to point to about what happened in Berkeley too, as well. If anybody knows about, there's this podcast. It's called Reveal. It's kind of an investigative news podcast. Sean and I talked a little about it last week. We both started listening to it recently. They had a short segment this past week called Rise of a Movement. And there was actually some of the reporters who were on the ground in Berkeley. And one of the reporters there that was kind of like hit by somebody, the reason why he got hit is that he went in and he did see one of the kind of black clad protesters, right? One of the anti-fascist radicals kind of come over and start hitting this guy and knocking this guy on the ground. This reporter saw what was going on and told him to stop, and then threw his own body on top of the other guy to prevent the guy from hitting him. And then he said, I got hit once with something. But then when he realized that I was a reporter and stuff like that, he held off and kind of stopped. Right. And he said that the whole thing, that whole altercation, was like happened in a flash. He said the vast majority of what went on there was peaceful protesting. It was intense, right, at times, but it was not that kind of attack. And I thought that was – and I literally just listened to this yesterday, and I was like, well, there you go. Here's someone who was on the ground, who was actually in the middle of it, and it was a reporter who was in a position to kind of spin things in the same way that you saw, for example, the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Washington Post, all these other things, but did not.
From papers who weren't even there.
Right. Exactly.
From papers that were following this on social media.
Right.
And watching for the sensational tweets and the sensational media for the video or content go up online.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And again, you know, I don't think you have to be reports
from the people.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say the reports of the people from on the ground there was a lot different than the reports that you saw coming from the mainstream media outlets who had no one there. And one of the things I'll leave it there.
Well, I think, you know, Sean, I've been playing around with this. I think that we're coming up with, some of these roundtable discussions and things like this that we want to do for our member only show. I think one of them should be around this issue. I think one of them should be really around talking a little bit more about strategy and kind of in a more in-depth way, because I mean, every time we get into this, right, every time we get into this, there's so many knotty questions that we need some space to actually play some of this stuff out. because I have a very, you and I were talking for a while before we went on the show today, and I have a very kind of, you know, like, and I'll break it down like this for the podcast today. The way I look at this is that this is not, when we talk about violence and attacking kind of like fascist and neo-Nazis and things like this, okay? For me, there's three different levels of discussion here. One has to do with me as an individual. And I will put it on the record right now. If I were sitting there and I saw some Nazi, right, and I'm by myself and I see some Nazi threatening somebody out like that or intimidating something like that, I have no problem going to that person, stopping it, laying that person out if I need to. Okay? That's me as an individual, and the consequences are me to an individual. When we start talking about larger protests and we start talking about, you know, people that are not all there to kind of directly confront, say, for example, neo-fascists and things like this, right? Then we're in the realm of political strategy, right? And if we're going to have any kind of effective political organization going forward, we have to think about political strategy that is going to kind of encompass that broad swath of people, right? And that is a political discussion, and there's not an automatic right answer here, right? But people have to be on the page, and I don't think we are there yet on the left. It feels like we have momentum, but we do not have an organizational infrastructure. And the last thing I'll say is this, is that I refuse for this stuff to kind of make the arguments about these abstract theoretical arguments, right? About the role of violence in the world and blah, 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 blah. And the correct, I will not do that because we're talking about real people on the ground here, right? Yes, I'm not saying that the theoretical and the ideological and stuff aren't important here. That's part of the conversation. But if we're going to build a political movement, we have to deal with what's happening on the ground. And I'll leave it at that because that's my one concern. Because just as you brought up, Sean, earlier, the media, right? We just watched what the media is going to do. And I don't think there's any hope whatsoever that the mainstream traditional corporate media is going to change its tune, right? We could point out all the hypocrisy we want in the world. We could point out all the ways in which what the media should be doing, right? But what they're going to do is they're going to fan the flames. They're going to give the right what they want. They're going to fan the flames against the left, right? And they're going to support, just like we saw in Harrisburg, which we'll talk about in the next segment, they're going to support police kind of further militarizing and using those kind of altercations as the justification for it. Is that right? Absolutely not, right? But it, I think, is a reality that we have to contend with and think very carefully about how we respond. But end diatribe.
And maybe I'll just throw one last point on there before we move along. But, like, you know, yesterday I was sitting, had some stuff to do, had to be out of my apartment in the morning before I go to work. So I was sitting in Little Amps for a while. One of the local older activists who's been here for a while, asked me if I wanted to be a peacekeeper or a marshal for a protest coming up. December 2nd, Saturday in Harrisburg, there's going to be a large anti-racist, anti-white supremacist, anti-fascist demonstration. You know, already on the Facebook page, 1,000 people said they're going. 10,000 said they're interested. The state is going to allow, since there's parking issues, the state's giving 100 parking spots and 5 bus spots for this event. It has the potential being something very huge. I asked me if I wanted to be a peacekeeper or a marshal for it, and I said yes. And one of the things we agreed on, we talked about, is like, listen, it's time we stop having these unity rallies. You know, the SPLC and other organizations have this wrong. If we're going to stop this type of overt racism, this fascism, this type of, you know, these white supremacist rallies, it's time to go right into their face. Not be violent, but confront them face-to-face on the streets, remain peaceful, and resist them openly in the public, because that's the only way that this stops. You know, if you nip it in the bud at the beginning, you have a chance to stop it before it's too late. And, you know, like, it's, you know, you see this stuff happening. There's militia groups all over the state. There's militia groups all over the country. You know, what's going to happen when we have these disasters, these man-made climate disasters 30, 40 years from now? Like, this is where we stop it now.
No, that's
before
right.
It gets out of control.
No, that's right. You know, and this is why I like
before
the,
you have.
Go ahead.
No, before you have the Eric Princes of the world securing, you know, their own private armies, you know, securing gated communities in some safe place for these millionaires and billionaires.
No, that's right. And I think this is why the image of Boston stands out to me so much, right? Where you had 40,000 protesters, anti-fascist protesters, basically in a complete circle, like 4, 5, 6 people deep, like around this small group of neo-fascists, right, that were kind of holding this rally. That for me symbolically is should be the direction that we're going. Like what would, and I'm, because again, I'm not a person who's against confrontation. I don't think having a nonviolent action means that you're not being confrontational. Those are not the same things, right? And if you talk to anybody in the civil rights movement and actually live through that, they will tell you the same thing. Nonviolent doesn't mean go off and play a guitar and sing Kumbaya, right? Nonviolent can actually be very confrontational, right? Those are different things.
I mean, taking your beatings in public, you know.
Right. Well, imagine this, Sean. I mean, imagine like you take these 3 percenters who keep on showing up armed, right? Imagine surrounding those people and saying, drop your arms. Drop your arms. This is nonviolent. Drop your arms. And making that a visible part of a protest, right? Now, that is confrontational and it's risky, right? Because those people are freaking nut jobs half the time, right? But it also demonstrates, again, what is that? What are we trying to show as a direction forward as a society? What is it that we want? What is it that we insist upon? I don't know. But so here, let me say this. So we're going on way long for this segment. Let me just mention a couple things real quick, and then we'll go into the next segment. One thing I do want to kind of highlight again, I did at the top of the show that right now there is a march to confront white supremacy going on, and you have about 100 faith leaders, activists, and students that are walking from Charlottesville to D.C. I would really hope that folks would, you know, click in the show notes and look for and follow them on there. Get on their Facebook page and show them some support. That would be really, really awesome. And I do think maybe we can lead this in the next segment, because I don't want to just give it short shrift. I think it's important to point out that we've got some interesting moves happening at Capitol Hill with Kamala Harris signing on to Bernie Sanders' universal health care bill. That seems to be kind of an important move. So we can talk about that briefly the next segment. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're going to take a quick break. Our break will be much shorter than our first segment, and then we'll get back to you with that in the next one. Just as a reminder, you can help us out, keep this going by going to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and become a member. And if you become a member at the $10 a month level, we will send you Mark Bray's new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Please do check that out. And if you don't want that, for whatever reason, we will send you a Raging Chicken Press original Stay Woke coffee mug instead. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day nearly 500,000 textile workers from Maine to Alabama walked off the job in a general strike. The United Textile Workers had launched an organizing campaign the year before. Within months, their membership had grown from 15,000 to well over 250,000. Working conditions and pay were abysmal. Normal work weeks averaged 55 hours. Child labor was widespread, and workers were always in fear of mill closings, pay cuts, and firings for suspected union activity. In the South, the industry had essentially been in a depression since the early 20s. The key issue was the stretch out. Workers were routinely expected to complete an increasing amount of work at the same rate and wage. For a brief moment, workers hoped their conditions would change when President Roosevelt signed the Code of Fair Competition the previous summer. It raised wages, limited hours, and prohibited child labor. It also allowed for union organizing. But the mill owners maneuvered around the code effectively, and the Textile Relations Board refused most workers' complaints. Fed up, workers walked out of the mill by the hundreds of thousands. They used the flying squadron tactic employed by Minneapolis Teamsters earlier that year, traveling from town to town, from mill to mill, calling workers out on strike. Mill owners were shocked. Within days, strikers confronted thousands of police and scabs. More than 40,000 National Guardsmen were called out in 16 states. Over the course of the strike, 16 people would be killed and hundreds more injured. After 22 days, union leaders called off the strike when President Roosevelt promised a government survey of industry conditions. It was an outrage, a betrayal, and a defeat felt for decades. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and I'm here once again, of course, with our muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, out there in Harrisburg. As we were talking about right before the break, I just wanted to get this in because I thought it was kind of an important development. That Kamala Harris signed on to Bernie Sanders' University Health Care Bill, and Sean, you kind of brought this to my attention this morning. I hadn't even seen this.
Yeah, it's just another good example of how pressure works. Kamala Harris is lining herself up to be the candidate in 2020 for the Democrats. And, she, like, in all honesty, is probably the neoliberal pick for this fight. And progressives have been, holding her feet to the fire, and they're starting to do it now. And she signed on to this bill. So, I mean, she's giving them lip service, but we'll see how much more issues that they could push her to the left before the campaign even ramps into high gear.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the way to frame it, is like that pressure works. And, I would argue that, you see the difference between the Kamala Harris who chose basically not to go ahead and prosecute Mnuchin, right, for mortgage fraud and all this other kind of stuff, the banking crap that he pulled out there in California. In my mind, the reason why she did not move forward with a prosecution at that point was because there was not pressure on her, enough pressure on her to do so, and all the money and the power was lined up with that kind of neoliberal, kind of like, Clinton-esque centrist ring of the Democratic Party.
And so one thing before we get into the next part, yeah. I saw this pop up on my Twitter and my Facebook feed before we actually started the program. Tim Ryan, who wanted to challenge Nancy Pelosi for the House leadership or House Democrats minority leadership position, mm-hmm. He has come out in support of Trump's corporate tax breaks today.
Wait, just say that again so we can all take that in, Sean.
The person who wanted to replace Nancy Pelosi from Ohio, Tim Ryan, came out in support and endorsed Donald Trump's corporate tax reform package.
Okay, I want everybody to sit with that for a little bit. And I want you to plug that into the narrative that we went crazy with in the first segment, right? And think about where that fits, right? That the one who wants to replace Nancy Pelosi, right, is in with the Trump campaign to give corporate tax breaks. Just suck on that for a little bit, all right? It's unbelievable.
Someone just ended his political career.
Well, let's hope. Yeah. Let's hope. All right, so let's it's not exactly shifting gears, but kind of out of that, I think it's a good move that we're seeing here. But I want to get back to the story about Harrisburg City Council and the police department. This is a story that you've been covering on the ground here, and it's kind of like a microcosm of what we're going to actually see increasing once again now nationally.
Yes, yeah, so we've been talking about this pretty much since beginning of July, late June. Harrisburg City Police Department made a request for $65,000 to purchase updated militarized riot gear. What they had before was older sticks, older shields, and helmets that were about 20, 25 years old. And they wanted, they requested to get 30 new sets of riot gear that is full head-to-toe riot gear with gas masks included. And City Council approved this on earlier this week by a 5-1 vote. The one representative, one city council member who voted against it was Shemaine Daniels. And she was present in Cincinnati in 2001 during the riots. And she stated that, the riot gear caused the riots to make it worse. Right. What happened back in Cincinnati in 2001. I didn't have time to look into the issue, but it was someone who was shot and killed, unarmed black man shot and killed for over 14 warrants out for his arrest, mostly unpaid traffic violations. That he got arrested, that he had, and he was shot and killed in a confrontation with the police. One of the things that troubles me with this is that if you do the math, there's maybe about 120 officers on the force, 30 to 120s, so that's almost a quarter. You take a number of how many of those officers are doing administrative work, how many of those officers are doing desk duty within the police department, within City Hall, that number gets lower. And, by just sheer percentage, it's about 25-30% of the whole entire force will have access to this full head-to-toe riot gear.
Right.
It's new, everything. They tried to spin this as protective gear. There's equating this to football equipment or baseball equipment, like a catcher's mask or a catcher's chest pad and knee pads and stuff like that. What we wrote about was, what's this actually for anti-fascist demonstrations, which is how they framed it. But at the public meeting back in July, they basically said one of the things they used as a threat was Senator Pat Toomey's televised town hall at ABC 27 Studios, which is on the out, like inside the city, but on the outskirts of the city, almost like getting outside of its political boundaries. Mm-hmm. And they said that that there was, this was a threat. We possibly might need this for here because there might be, because violence could be possible. Four people were arrested at that event. They were disabled activists in wheelchairs who were basically cited for blocking an entrance to the building. The people who attended this rally were not anti-fascist. They were pretty much like West Shore, I hate to say this, but like your white liberal protesters from the more affluent areas of the region protesting against Pat Toomey. And they used this as a way to justify purchasing riot gear.
Right. Now, we should say, too, in that protest, that protest was about the Medicare cuts, right? Or Medicaid cuts and kind of the rollback of Obamacare. So we're talking about a completely separate issue here.
Yeah, this was completely before the vote failing in the Senate, weeks before that. So that happens, and then Charlottesville happens, and then at City Council they cited Charlottesville as a reason why getting this gear, one of the reasons why, and one of the compromises was that in order to get the funding, they must have additional training and have a citizen review board created, which might sound like a great compromise, but what the activists wanted and what some of the community groups wanted was they wanted a citizens review board, the activists.
Right. It was an advisory board that they passed, right?
Yes. Then the police department wants an advisory board, which is a neutered, really has no power to produce tangible results.
It's like a customer service suggestion box people kind of thing.
Yes, pretty much. And either of these moves have to get approved by a local police union. But one of the council members that voted for it basically said, I voted for this, but what's uncomfortable is the fact we're doing this in a reactionary sense, you know, reacting to certain past events instead of doing it in a proactive stance.
It's crazy. You know, I think that the example you gave of Cincinnati is an important one to kind of think about how the gear actually connects up to the tactics.
Last year, there was an incident, a kid who had mental health issues, allegedly had his mother at knife point. Police shot and killed this person.
Through the window, right?
Through the window, yes. And a lot of protests broke out. A few hundred people hit the streets the very next day as word was getting out. It just makes you, if you want to have a little thought experiment, what happened to that? Cops in riot gear versus cops in soft gear, soft clothing.
Exactly.
How imagine how much that, you know, the city hasn't had a riot since the 60s when that was happening across the city, the country at the time. So imagine where this would have elevated to if the police were out in riot gear, and how that would have changed the mindset of the crowd that was out there protesting at the time, marching in the streets. Imagine how that would have upped the risk of having a full-blown riot simply because the riot gear was there.
No, right. Especially when there's – I mean, I look at it like this, right? If you're going to put on the costume, right, you're more likely to behave like in character, right? I mean, that's kind of what it is. If you're going to buy this kind of this riot gear that, you show up to a protest in that riot gear, you are feeling in that thing like, okay, you are here to make sure that, that you're going to put down the riot, as opposed to if you are there in soft clothing with maybe some minor protection, right? You as an individual are going to respond accordingly. You're not going to be as apt to go in to try to push people, start beating people. Right there. And if you're not showing up in like full riot gear and a gas mask, guess what? You're not going to use right away. Tear gas. Right.
Because so something had just happened. There's an outdoors bar, and like a skirmish broke out at this bar, and police broke out the mace, and they maced like 15 or 20 people on a Saturday night at this bar over an incident involving one person.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Like 15 or 20 people got maced because they were in the vicinity of the cops macing the people.
Christ.
So they can't even use, like, they have a really hard time using pepper spray and mace correctly.
Right. This is why you get into rules, like, issues of training and rules of engagement and all this kind of stuff becomes important. Is the fact that, you know, again, like, I'll never forget the Majority Report one night. There was a guy who called in, was a guy who served kind of several tours in Iraq, and then came back to do some kind of training stuff like that with police departments across the country. And he said what astonished him is that, you know, the fact that in Iraq, right, the rules of engagement were such that you could not raise your weapon and point it at someone unless you were 100% sure that this person was a threat. Like, if a car was driving up to, like, driving up to you, you couldn't raise the weapon just because it's a car. Right, you had to wait to ensure that you could say that there was a threat was part of the rules of engagement. And then we started consulting with police departments in the U.S. They had the exact opposite. The assumption was in their training, according to this guy, in their training manuals and the ways that we were being talked to, was like, assume the threat to begin. Like, put your weapon up, protect yourself at all costs first. Right. The problem with that, of course, is, as so many people have been pointing out, is that that brings to the fore, right, all your presumptions about race and all presumptions about crime and who's good and who's bad and all that kind of stuff. If you are presuming and you're being asked to and you're being trained to look for threats, you're going to see them more often. Right. And we do not have those kind of the rules of engagement like that they had in Iraq. We do not have them in police departments across this country. So you start putting these two things together and you start seeing that this is a recipe for disaster. We're going to see more of that kind of stuff.
Right. And
well, especially when you've got, like, I mean, again, this is not in Harrisburg, but especially when you've got freaking, like, practically overt racists down there, like, in outside Philadelphia, like, after this one Black Lives Matter protest.
Yeah. So there was a question, again, there was a questionable shooting of a person who dropped his gun running away from the cops, shot in the back, and there has been no charges brought forward against this cop yet. So a bunch of over the past month, since the event happened, it was a little quiet, but over the past couple of months, Black Lives Matter activists have been interrupting press conferences with the mayor and some powerful city council members and city officials demanding the arrest of this officer. And so they stepped up their actions one step further. They held a protest outside of this cop's Northeast Philadelphia home. And in response, John McNesby, president of the FOP Lodge 5, Fraternal Order of Police, at the rally, I don't know if it was at the rally or to the reporter, but he called these Black Lives Matter activists a group of rabid animals. And, you know, really, one of the people speaking at this event where this was said was State Representative Martina White, who, you know, basically, you know, if we're going to start calling out racists in our legislature, you have to ask her why she was there and does she denounce this type of rhetoric?
Yeah, no kidding. And, like, you know, let's see where Harry is. Let's put the words in this guy's mouth, okay? So this is from Newsworks, right? NPR's Newsworks out of Philadelphia. So let me just read from this. You can hear the whole context. It says, quote, before a friendly crowd, including hundreds of former and active officers, John McNesby, president of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 5, rallied against local members of Black Lives Matter who traveled to Officer Ryan Pownell's Northeast Philadelphia home last week to protest his slaying of a subject. Now, this is McNesby. Quote, when you go to work each day, you shouldn't have to worry that a pack of rabid animals will suddenly show up for your home and openly threaten your family, said McNesby inside FOP headquarters. Quote, these are not activists. These are racist hate groups determined to instigate violence. There was no sign of Black Lives Matter activists inside or outside of Thursday's Back the Blue event, although the group had promised further actions later in the week. Right, so there you go. I mean, this is the PR wing, right, of the FOP. You can only imagine what's happening, like, behind closed doors.
It makes you wonder how racist the cops are inside this police department. If that's your that's your president.
That's exactly. And that's the guy. That is what he's saying to the media. Right. Make sure you quote me on this. Right. It's crazy, man.
Yeah,
it's crazy, man. We got a lot to deal with.
So which Nazi article should we talk about next?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's what I was just thinking. It's like, well, let's see. How do you transition from racist cop to racist? Right. I mean, this is OK. So give us a little context here, Sean. This is something right before. Literally, we're sitting there getting ready to go on. And Sean's like, oh, my God. You got to see this, right? And so he sent me this link. So walk us through the new kind of alt-right PR campaign out there in Harrisburg.
So someone who worked in the Cumberland County Republican Party and the Cumberland County the clerk office for the courts, whatever, is the executive director for the National Policy Institute, which is Richard Spencer's extremely racist neo-Nazi lobbying arm of it's basically the lobbying arm of the neo-fascist neo-Nazi movement. Spencer up and moved this place to Alexandria, Virginia, because that's where the action's happening. Hey, you know, and Frank, quite ironically, this is the same place where there's Vanguard American people came from for their anti-Sharia law march back in June. But I digress. So this guy, Evan McLaren, went crying to the media saying he's not a Klansman or a Nazi. He's not a Nazi. He's just someone who is American of European heritage.
Yeah, we just want to make sure we protect white heritage, Sean. Like, you know, and things that matter to keep whiteness going. Things like, I don't know, segregation and slavery and superiority, things like that.
Yeah, and so this prompted a lot of blowback from the Republican Party in the county Republican Party, mm-hmm. saying, oh, we didn't know he was a Nazi. We didn't know about this. And there was actually some like good back and forth online. Mm-hmm. You know, a state representative said, I denounce all form of hatred. You know, and he linked to this article, and I chimed in. Yeah, but what about Daryl Metcalf? You're the person like the next district over.
Yep. There you go. You know, we should say that McLaren. So just so everybody knows, this guy he's a 2017 graduate. Oh, sorry, wait. This is who is this guy?
He's from Dickinson Law School.
Yeah. He's a 2017 graduate of the Dickinson School of Law. He was briefly treasurer of the county's Young Republicans. It said he left early in the year. He was also a law clerk with Cumberland County District Attorney's Office, and he served as a judicial extern for a federal judge in the Western District of Pennsylvania.
And so it makes you like, so this guy has worked his way into the system. One of the funny things is someone tweeted about this, right? And it's funny seeing how people react. Like when we put up that guy's picture, Christian Yingling from the militia group, we had a couple people messaging us. Yeah, this guy's an asshole. I had to deal with him. I had to work with him, actually. I actually had to like deal with him. It's great seeing like those responses came in. Mm-hmm. And basically like people who are his classmates, like, yeah, this guy's a Nazi. We all know it. We hate this guy. He's an asshole. You know, some people like him, but they're just basically the racists that like him.
Well, what's funny about that, right? Because then you've got this Katie Moyer, right? Who's the chairwoman of the Cumberland Young Republicans, right? She basically said, she's like, oh, you know, we don't really even have that member. I had no idea of his views. But then you see kind of like the back and forth, as Zach, you said, is like people are saying, oh, yeah, it's kind of clear. This guy wasn't like, you know, trying to hide behind this kind of stuff. He was open about this stuff.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. You know, and just so again. So
and he was also arrested in Charlottesville.
Oh, was he really? There you go.
Yes.
beautiful. And so that if anybody has any questions about it, so here the Southern Poverty Law Center has deemed that that term, the identitarianism, is kind of the latest kind of term that the kind of white supremacists are from the alt-right are trying to use. And this is what the Southern Poverty Law Center says. It says they have deemed that term to be a euphemism for racism and hate. Duh. It has labeled Spencer as a suit-and-tie version of the white supremacist of old, a kind of professional racist in khakis. The center considers the National Policy Institute to be a hate group. Right? And again, just as a reminder, I know people are getting up to speed on this stuff, and thank God that you all are, and that we all are, and that we're kind of seeing what the connections between these things. But, you know, they are well positioned to do this. And something I thought was very interesting that I've just started reading. I started reading this book by Nancy McLean called Democracy in Chains. And if you recall, Richard Spencer, he was also a graduate of the University of Virginia, right down there in Charlottesville. What I did not know, right, I originally got Democracy and Change because I've been reading every book I can about looking at the past about 40-year history of the rise of the, the libertarian billionaire class, like the Koch brothers and so on, and following that trajectory. What this – it follows this It follows this guy, James McGill Buchanan, who founded a center at the University of Virginia back, I think, in the 50s, earlier 60s, that was basically to set up. It was called the Thomas Jefferson Center for something or other, law and economic policy or something like this. But basically what it was a think tank that was designed to build the ideological spine and infrastructure to preserve, to take like the nice words away, white supremacy and white supremacy through economic policy over the long term. Right. And this is the place. This is the place where Richard Spencer studied. Right. And where the kind of quote unquote Virginia School of Economics. Well, I'll be honest. I had no idea that that even existed. Right. This whole kind of School of Economics as a mode of thought came from Buchanan, according to Nancy McLean. And this is under which Richard Spencer was kind of helped indoctrinated. And one of the things that was a central feature of the of that school in Virginia was the fact that they knew that they could not use overt racist words. They could they had to cloak things in language that was going to be presentable. And I don't think it's a coincidence that when Richard Spencer comes out of there, founds the National Policy Institute, that they're following in the footsteps of that school.
Yeah. And one of the things I think we have to make a link to that, like, you know, libertarian economics, you know, I'm working on the story, don't want to tip it off, but, you know, libertarian economics and Austrian school of Austrian economics, you know, these libertarian like ideologies of Hayek and stuff like that, they go hand in hand with white supremacy.
Yes.
And,
absolutely right.
And racism. You know, they people don't want to talk about that, but yes, they go hand in hand with racism. You know, and with the white supremacy that we're seeing today. You know, it's their economic backing, it's their economic intellectual foundation, pretty much.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that what's important, you know, it's been commonplace in the left for a long time to say that, look, or at least I shouldn't say long time, but at least fairly recently, you know, the discussion has always been, right, you can't deal with class without dealing with race and without dealing with gender, right? You have this kind of intersectionality that these things impact one another. And often, I think, in common discourse, when people think about, you know, racism, sexism, patriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, all these things, they see them as kind of these parallel kind of interplaying dynamics, right? Now, what this democracy and change does, and what exactly what you just said, Sean, following this trajectory of libertarian thought, is that you see that these aren't just kind of separate things that impact them. They have been there's been choices that have been made, right, to actively ensure that this new brand of capitalism, this libertarian stuff, is infused with the white supremacy and patriarchy. Right, that they might not have used those words exactly explicitly, but they look to basically write into law and into policy those very things. And why I'm saying that's important is because you're saying it's like there's people at the very top, right, who are aware about how these things are interconnected and they want to preserve that system. So again, I recommend that book, Democracy and Change by Nancy McLean. It's like it's been I read that one. I'm reading this one right on the heels of a book called White Rage. So you can see this. Cool. So there you have it, man. Anything else happen around the state, Sean?
You know.
Hey, I got a question. Where are we at with the budget? You have an idea?
I don't think it's getting done soon.
What's that?
I don't think it's getting done soon. But something that did happen, I don't know if you heard about this. Senator Wagner said something that was pretty racist.
Oh yeah, Senator Soprano. How can we leave this segment without talking about Senator Soprano? You know, because we have to remember. Let's just remember. Senator Soprano.
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive.
That's our good friend, Senator Soprano. So, yeah, tell us about this show.
So, you know, I want to preface this by saying I took my ramp training last week, right? Responsible alcohol management program.
Yes.
And basically it's how to serve alcohol. Everyone has to be like, we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but basically anyone who serves alcohol at the point of purchase has to be ramp certified now in Pennsylvania, and it's how to identify people who might be a little tuned up.
Tuned up, that's a nice phrase.
So last week, Scott Wagner, basically said that you know, George Soros is a Hungarian Jew who has a hatred for America, and he said this to a tracker. And this was at some sort of like tomato fair, or like state fair up in Pittston, Pennsylvania, which is like outside of Scranton. And, you know, from watching the video, I think he might have had a couple of drinks before he said this. But, you know, the way he just nonchalantly threw that out there, like, you know, just like the way, you know, you have a couple of drinks in you and it just rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, it loosens you up a little bit, you know, takes down the inhibitions, right? No need to watch my words here. Soros, did freaking Hungarian Jew who's fun in the left, man.
And he hates America. He just has a hatred of America.
Hates America, that Hungarian Jew. Did I mention he was a Jew?
You know, throw some dog whistles out there.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like he threw the dog whistle to the wind.
But so one of the things that like surprised me about this, like, okay, you can listen to the audio. I think it was very over the top, anti-Semitic, racist. I talked to some Jewish friends I have, you know. But then after he says it, he has like that oh shit moment. He's like, but I have Jewish friends, you know. Hey, we got some.
Yeah, they're not black Jewish friends, but they're Jewish.
And, you know, like last week on the podcast, we were talking about, you know, his lame ass statement and how he felt like one line short of saying he has black friends.
Right.
Well, you know, he in that same op-ed that he wrote for Penn Live, he stated he had Jewish friends. And then he says something very anti-Semitic, and then he goes back saying, but I have Jewish friends and I do stuff for the Jewish community. Yeah. Calling someone a Jew, not really that good. And also, if you know the history of Hungary, you know, Hungary was also part of the Holocaust. You know, a lot of Hungarians had to flee Hungary because of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. There was some famous, like, you know, pogroms up there and stuff like this. You know, you listen to Chapo Trap House. Not in Hungary, but one of the countries surrounding that, Heimbach, that kid Matthew Heimbach, mm-hmm. he actually had a shirt on of like this this fascist leader. It might be Bolivia or no. I'm trying to think. I don't know the country, but it's not Hungary. But basically, like this guy who hung a bunch of like Jewish people on hooks in a meat house. Yeah. You know, you listen to this paid episode mm-hmm. From the Antifa thing right after they made available to the public. You know, mm-hmm. basically, like, you know, and you get to learn your history about this. You know, you put that qualifier in there saying he's Hungarian, not just a Jew, but he's Hungarian.
Right.
It makes you want to look up the history of the Hungarian Holocaust. You know, because a lot of these countries, like Poland and other, you know, countries, you know, you don't talk about the Holocaust, but, you know, the Holocaust did happen in these countries and they fell to fascism pretty quickly.
No, that's right. Now let's not forget, just this week, right, the other part of that history, right, that of that Hungarian history is Sebastian Gorka, right, who was just kicked to the curb.
Vice Rend.
Right, whose father...
Whose dad was part of the Vice Rend.
Right, directly affiliated with the Nazis, right? And so that you put that Hungarian tradition next to, say, Soros, whose family kind of, you know, got away, you know, that kind of stuff. The fact you put those two things next to one another, and then you interject Senator Wagner's comment, and you can see how this plays itself out.
Yeah, and one of the things that really... is how the media covered this. Oh, Senator Winter, not George Soros. No, he said something that was really fucking anti-Semitic. Like, you know, like he didn't like knock him. Oh, you know, take swipe or takes aim at Soros. No, he said something like very anti-Semitic. And it was, you know, astounding that none of the newspapers really called out that type of racism on its head. I mean, the way and the manner which he said it, there was no laughing manner. There was no punchline. There was no follow through. He called him a Jew who hates America.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you ever have any question about a statement like that, whether it's not, I suggest you do exactly what Sean did. Ask around to your, you know, your Jewish friends, right, Senator Wagner? Well, if I was going to public and I were to say that Soros was a Hungarian Jew that hated America, how would that sound to you? Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, we should also remember that Cohen, you know, Trump's lawyer, right, and Mnuchin, you know, Trump's kind of economic guy, right, are also both Jewish. Right.
And it's also, if you look into,
go ahead,
if you look into Scott Wagner's political funding history in 2012, he actually gave a $1,000 check to Lyndon LaRouche's political action campaign committee. And LaRouche was a pretty like far out there conspiracy theorist, cult leader. and pretty anti-Semitic for the things he said over the years.
Exactly, exactly. At least we'll get to colonize the moon.
It makes you wonder who he gave his money to.
Oh, exactly. Well, I think, you know, hey, if there's any enterprising young souls who would like to kind of get on some of the public record requests, we could start figuring that out out there. So crazy, crazy, crazy. All right. Anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
No, I think all that was said that needed to be said.
Just remember, everybody, I can.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
That's exactly the truth. We're learning what that is right now. Here comes the Empire. So everybody, we'll come back after this for our last call of the day, and kind of get some Star Wars fun. We'll get into some coffee fun and some things like that. But just as a reminder, if you go to RagingChickenPress.org, click on the support membership tab, you can become a member at the $5 a month level. We also like to say that we're kind of making some room right now to bring on two additional writers. We'd love to have somebody that's based out of the Lehigh Valley, especially. But we want some folks that are be covering policy. They're basically taking the stuff that you hear here on this podcast, right? You see kind of happening in the pages of Raging Chicken Press, and kind of digging deep into this because, you know, we need to do our due diligence right now, folks. And, you know, as much as it gets a little weird and like it starts feeling like, man, you know, am I like, going down the conspiracy road here, or I'm actually just being rational, right? And I hate to say it, but we're kind of falling on we're just being rational side and trying to look where we're going. We want some folks to dig into that and kind of, you know, expose these people for what they are. So anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this with our last call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive, activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coup podcast, and we're here for Last Call on this Force Friday. But we thought we got to kick things off a little bit. Senator Wagner has shown his skills at doing his own version of stand-up. We're going to pass this one off to Sean Kitchen.
So I have a joke that I came up with over the past week. You want to hear it?
Yeah, let's hear it, Sean.
Okay, so a child, a theocrat, and a racist walks into the bar. What do you have?
I don't know. What do you have, Sean?
The PA Senate GOP primary.
Oh! I think the hardest part of that joke is to matching up those people with the actual candidates.
So basically, you had Jim Christiana, the child, and the theocrat, and Rick Saccone announced their run for the Senate months ago. We all remember that video of Saccone saying, and my God will make a seed of a nation. You know, talking about William Penn and his religious liberty.
Exactly.
And this past week, Lou Barletta announced his run for U.S. Senate, which the clown car gets bigger.
The clown car gets bigger, man. I'm strapping in, man. Oh, my gosh. I mean, just when do you think, you know, you got any sense of when you think that's really going to kick itself off? Like when we're actually going to see the major campaigning?
I don't know, but it's going to be this is going to be one to watch. I mean, it's also scary because Barletta sits on FAIR. It's an anti-immigrant group that's been labeled as a white supremacist organization.
Yep.
He sits on their their board. He's refusing to leave it, and he pretty much cut his teeth by going after immigrants and refugees over the past pretty much his whole entire political career.
Yeah, well, there we have it. I mean, you know, I'm waiting for that is scary. I mean, you could follow that out. I'm waiting for one of them to basically throw the first punch, so to speak. And my guess is
the fireworks going.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm serious.
Like the powder keg.
The powder keg is set, right? I mean, I've got this image from the Game of Thrones, right? Have you watched Game of Thrones? You watch the whole thing?
I have never watched Game of Thrones.
Oh man, you're missing out. I'm telling you. If you can get past all the kind of like excessive nudity from the first couple seasons, right? And then you get into the storyline, it's a great. Or just read the books. The books are great, right? But there's this scene, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched Game of Thrones. Oh, no, I can't spoil it for you. I'm just going to say there's something that happens in not this season, but last season of Game of Thrones, which is a big boom. And that's all I'm going to say. So any of you who watch Game of Thrones, right, I'm just going to say Cersei Lannister, big boom. You know what I'm talking about. It's the same kind of logic going on here. But that's it. So I think that if I had to predict, I'm going to say one of them is going to come out probably around October. It may be a little bit sooner. We'll see. And they're going to take a swing at Casey, right? And then that's going to kind of prompt people getting in. But what's going to be the fun part of it is because after they've all taken their swings at Casey, they're going to have to start taking the swings at themselves. And that's just going to be like, that's the shit show right there.
Yeah.
I just hope everything's televised. That's all I'm saying. It's all I ask, right? Small things.
Pay-per-view.
No. I want it free, public for everybody. Free, live stream. Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, so, just moving on, I guess we had some beer stuff. I got Ramp certified last week.
Certified. So, therefore, whenever Sean is not drunk, he'll be able to tell if you are.
So, I watched the McGregor fight. The Conor McGregor Mayweather fight.
Oh, you did? I only read about it afterwards, actually.
I watched it online. I found a free stream. Uh-huh. I watched it for free. Actually, pretty good quality. And, the fight ended around like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And we all had to be in work at 7 mm-hmm. Sunday morning to do the ramp certification course, which was a 3-hour course. So, like, all the guys who worked there and a couple of the girls. Everyone stayed up to watch the fight. So we're just all like, I mean, it's the type of thing where like I went to bed at 2 and I woke up at 5:30. So it was like I slept for 3 hours. It's not even a sleep. That's a nap at that point. Yeah. Like,
you know what I call that? My normal semester schedule.
Like to me, that's a nap. I'm just like, I can't do this every day. So it was one, but it was actually a pretty fun course. Just learning about the seriousness of serving people alcohol. We had some fun with the instructor, and I got 100. I got all the questions right on the test. So.
There you go. Congratulations, Sean. You're a very good boy. Oh man, I should give you the sticker smiley face right now, right?
And we have a beer release coming up.
Oh, what's coming out
Saturday? Pizza Boy has started this stainless steel sour program.
Okay,
so. Where they would brew a sour, they condition it, they ferment it with Brett and sour yeast, right, off-site. Because mm-hmm. you can't have that in your brewery because it'll just destroy everything.
Uh-huh.
Most of our sour beers sit in barrels for about a year to 3 years before we bottle them. And, you know, it costs a lot of money to do that. So that's why the bottles are like $30 a bottle, $25 or $35 a bottle in between that range. Uh-huh. What they did here was They put this in a stainless steel tank. They got about 1,000 bottles. $9 for a 12-ounce bottle of a pineapple from pineapple sour. That they ferment it in a stainless steel tank with Brett yeast for a year. So it's going to be pretty good.
Awesome, man. Well, I just found out that too as well. Found out too late yesterday. It's just been, this is like back to school week for me, and I've just been, you know, just shifting gears to get everything up and running. And of course, there's always like tech issues at the beginning of the year, so I haven't paying as much attention to like my world outside of work. But yesterday, Free Will just had another can release, and it's called Freshy, right? It's a wet hopped IPA. They released the cans at 3 p.m. So I got a call over there today, and I think we're going to go up to the mountains for the weekend. It's got a long Labor Day weekend this weekend, and go up to the mountains. And I think I want to stop there and see if I can, if they have any left, to pick some up for us there. So, but I saw that you at least enjoyed the freshness of the Chasing the Dragon.
Yep, I did a lot.
It's pretty good. I think I've got one 4-pack left. So I passed.
Jesus.
I was giving them out. Right, there's some of my like you know back to school like you know thing. So I got a case of it, and I gave some to some friends and things like that. And I guess you count as one if you're gonna you know. But I did. I have to say, I'm sorry to say that I missed Sour Sunday at Free Will this past weekend. I was really looking forward to it, but you know, it's back to school, not just for me but for my kids. And the night before, like Saturday night, my son Rowan comes up and he says, hey, you know, I was thinking tomorrow's the last day of the summer, and I thought it might be kind of fun to have a couple of friends over and like you know play outside and stuff and have a back to school party. And he was like so sweet about it. So I'm like, okay, sure. And so that next morning, Sunday morning, and this was like right before I went to bed, and Sunday morning, I went around and kind of called all his friends. And I'm like, you know, I told him, I said, listen, it's a day before school, you know, probably, you know, people are doing stuff and getting ready and all that stuff. So don't be surprised if no one can come. Turns out all of them could come. So we had like a house full of kids, and it was a blast. It really was. They were out with their scooters and stuff, playing video games, basketball, all that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of fun. But I missed the Sour Sunday, so I'm just going to have to wait till the next time around to get out there. So sorry, folks, I cannot report on it. If you were there, let me know. That'd be cool. So yeah. So that's that, I guess. I'm just thinking about that. But at least maybe I'll be able to get over to get the cans this week. So hey, so Sean, did you download the Force Friday app, and you're going to go out and have your augmented reality day?
No, I did not.
Well, 'cause today is Force Friday, right? And of course, now since Star Wars is owned by Disney, you know, today they're launching all their new gear, right? You know, by gear they mean toys and stuff, right? Because you got the new movie coming out in December, so today's like the big launch. I guess they did this last year too as well, and they're trying to get people out there to do this with this this app on their phone. It's like augmented reality where you go to the stores and there's like a cardboard cutout and you scan something and you can take your picture next to it. You know, kind of like it's like they're trying to it looks like they're trying to capitalize on the kind of Pokemon Go kind of approach to things. But this is my prediction, right? That app is going to be huge fail, right? I watched somebody, you're trying to get people excited about having to drive to go to the mall to find this thing that you're going to do this. I don't think so. So
malls still exist.
They do, believe it or not, they do exist. But you can go. No, don't worry. You can also do it at your big box stores, right? You can do it at Best Buy. You can do it at Target. So,
what about Walmart?
Walmart, too. Walmart is on board with it, too, as well. So they get all that kind of thing. But whatever. I just know that I'm still, as much as I love Star Wars, I just can't get excited about a Force Friday that's trying to just get me to buy stuff. But I am looking forward. We're kind of the tick down on for the release of the new Star Trek series is coming up on the 23rd. I'm so excited. Sean just basically fell asleep on the other end. But I have one more confession to make to you, Sean.
I think this is the best part of the pre-show.
Yeah. if everybody recalls, last week we talked a little about, Sean was awesome enough to bring me back some Modern Times coffee, and if anybody ever drank their stouts, you know, known through their beer, Sean, you were saying that they actually started as a coffee company, right?
Yes, and the coffee is freaking phenomenal.
Yeah, so Sean brought it back to me. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say I averaged like a 5-cup pod of coffee every morning for the past week, and it's gone now.
Yeah.
So, it
is really good. And like, well, last week we talked, and you know, he gave me whole bean stuff, and I used to have a grinder, but I haven't had one. It broke, and I couldn't get the burr replacements and stuff years ago. So I just, you know, whatever. Just I haven't had whole bean in a while, and I have somebody had given me another thing of whole bean from, you know, this kind of bourbon barrel kind of aged coffee bean thing, or whatever. So I had that one, and then Sean gave me these, and so okay, I'm just, you know, now this is the sign, right? It's time to kind of buy a grinder. And I just didn't want to get like I didn't want to get another appliance, right? So I was looking online and I found these, like, you know, hand grinders, right? So a little crank on it and things like this, right? And I was like, oh, I'm going to get that. Like, and then Sean was making fun of me last week, like, oh, is this save the earth with every crank, right? That kind of thing. So I got the thing, right? I got it in the mail. It's this cool little thing. It was like, you know, great. And then I said, okay, good. I'm going to grind up some coffee and I'm going to do this, right? So I poured a coffee into it and I start grinding. And grinding and grinding. And I'm like 3 minutes into this. And I'm like, I'm not a person who has patience with the world. Right. I can't believe this. Right. So I finally, I was able to kind of get myself right after switching hands multiple times because my wrist was freaking getting tired from grinding damn thing. So I went out and finally bought an electric grinder, Sean. I did.
How many times you brewed the coffee? Is like, was it after the first time or like the second or third time?
No, after the first time. I'm like, forget this. My wrist was still sore when I ordered that damn thing. Are you kidding me? I'm sitting there. I'm like, God bless the electronic age. Bring it in, man. Set it to what you want. Like, press the button and you're done.
It's like a mortar and pestle.
Yeah, exactly. Like I was saying to you, what I was saying to you at the outside is like, I had a friend whose like parents had this big like old timey kind of coffee grinder, right? It looked almost
like a 3-foot gear.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh man, two cranks.
Exactly. Right. So I was like, I used to go over to their house. I'm like, what is this thing? It has this big, huge crank on the side of it, right? Built out of like iron or something, you know. It looks like, you know, almost like the
company. Weighs like 80 pounds.
No, it's more than that, dude. This thing is like that. It sits on the floor. It's like 3 feet high, right? It's this huge.
It's like bolted into the joists on the.
Basically, right? Exactly, right? And so they, I'm like, what is this? Oh, it's a coffee grinder, and I'm like, whoa, whatever. And then, sure enough, you pour your coffee in there. You give this thing like a few cranks. You got your coffee. So that's what I have in my head, right? But there's a difference when you have a gear that's, you know, the size of a pie plate versus this gear that's the size of like a grape, right? So I'm sitting there like squeak, 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 and meanwhile, like, I'm getting that like caffeine headache, you know, because you need your first thing. I'm like, I cannot do this. I have failed. I admit it. I would never make it as a hipster in this world. Oh man. And part of it was funny. I was thinking about it later. It's like, you know, there is some guy somewhere, right? And it's going to be like, you know, a guy who's kind of like all earthy and things like this and really, really good shape, right? And is like calm about the world and is sitting out there like on a hillside in his tent, right? That he's talked us around and is like the hike for the day and he's grinding it and feeling really good about it, right? And I'm not saying that to make fun of that guy. I'm saying I'm not that guy. but that's a long way around of saying, man, that coffee is awesome. And what really took me back, Sean, more than anything else about that, I mean, other than just being good coffee, is like, I totally recognize it from their stouts. Right? I mean, it really is. I mean, when you have that, it's that particular roast. I'm like, holy crap. I mean, it's like this flashback of like remembering drinking their stouts. And I was like, that's it.
And one of the things I did, it's like I went online to make sure they do ship their coffee anywhere within the country. Yeah. So I think like every couple of months I might just splurge and get a bag of this Dark House coffee. The Black House is freaking phenomenal. Like the thing about it, it's like it, once it cools down a little bit, like it has like that almost like a muddy brown, yes, type color to it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it just like it has like it's a little bit thicker and I'm just like, oh my God, it's so good. And I you know, I do one scoop per cup. you know, the ratio is maybe like an extra scoop on top, like, mm-hmm. you know, six scoops for a 5-cup pot.
Yeah.
You know, just that extra little bit of strength. But yeah, when I have coffee in my apartment, like, it's a 5-cup pot of coffee in the morning.
Yeah,
and that's what gets my day going.
Well, I know. I'm glad that you're able to. I'm glad you're able to eat to drink that little, right? You know, good that you cut back on it. You don't overdo it on the coffee. Because I'm not
like
that.
I wake up today. It's like 8 o'clock. And I was like, I need coffee before we do this podcast.
Oh man. Well, the one thing after I had that coffee and after I got my real grinder, right? It's like my like
is that
you
the
know
app or the sandwich?
The 21st freaking century grinder. And I was like, one of the things I was just kind of poking around. I was curious, and I think it was after you sent me the link to say you can order this stuff online. So I just kind of just was poking around about Modern Times and their background and stuff. And they had just decided, this is really, I thought, really cool. They had just kind of voted as the company that to become the first all employee owned brewery in California. It was fascinating. It was like it happened just like a few weeks. It was probably right before you were out there. They made this decision, and so they're moving. They're doing like these buybacks of like investors and things like this, and it's going to be all employee owned. And there's no other brewery in California who's doing that. It was really interesting hearing them talk about that. It was saying, okay, look, as craft beer is, it's the industry has grown so much so that you're actually getting, there's more competition and things like this. But then you've got the big players, right? The InBev, all those kind of things who are trying to go through and buy out the craft beers. They were looking to say, look, we need to kind of have a sustainable model going forward. We just don't want to, we're not going to go down that road. So what do? And say, well, why don't we turn it into this employee-owned model so that we're doing this for ourselves, right? And I thought that was awesome to see, right? And I hope to see this as a trend that it will kind of increasingly make its way throughout the, throughout the craft beer world, because that's awesome. It's a testament to those folks there in that brewery.
Yeah, and they did it in response to all the other bigger breweries in the area selling out to the corporate giants.
Right, exactly. It's like, asking themselves directly, well, how do we make a different choice? Like, we don't want to do that. So what do? And they look into it. And yes, it turns out, guess what, folks, is that employee owned, right, industries actually do really well, right? Because they're not sitting there to basically, feed the bottom line of their corporate stocks. They're basically feeding, yes, obviously they need to be profitable and things like this, but it's about all going back into the people who are actually running it. I'm like, kudos to Modern Times for that. So anything else for the good of the order today, Sean?
No, I think it's just time to decompress.
Time to decompress. I know it's been quite a podcast. I know we're already. It's like right now we're in hour. Let's see, we're almost hitting 2-hour mark today. That's not good. It's pretty crazy. So, anyways, folks, thanks for sticking in there with us today. As you can see, we came in with a head full of energy for this back to school episode, and we're going to keep it going. So as a reminder, if you can, we need your support. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, click on become a member, you'll be on your way, or leave us a one-time donation. You click donate, leave us a one-time donation, that'd be awesome. Our writers, thank you, and a reminder that we are like literally less than $20 away from hitting our first goal. And if we hit that first goal, that means we're going to be able to pay our writers even more. So your impact now is triple, right? And if you become a member at the $10 a month level, we will send you Mark Bray's book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, or Raging Chicken's exclusive Stay Woke coffee mug. All right, so this is Kevin Mahoney. I'm going to get out of here, Sean. Have an awesome day, man.
I will. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you later.
There you go. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm going to get out of here. We're going to get out of here and go, enjoy the rest of this day. We will see you back right here next week. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder. We are out of here. See ya!
Auto-destruct sequence armed.